In today's episode, I'll cover the Nolan Arenado trade and how it impacts his fantasy value for 2021. Plus, we'll talk draft strategy today and what you can do to prepare for your leagues this season. That's today on Fastball Fantasy Baseball. I'm Taylor Tarter, and this is Fastball Fantasy Baseball. Let's get into it. Didi Gregorius re-signed with the Phillies for 2 years. Gregorius actually had a pretty solid 2020 campaign. He hit .285 with 10 home runs and contributed in runs and RBI as well. There are some signs that the .285 was probably a little higher of a batting average than it should have been. His BABIP was up in the small sample size from last season. And so I'd expect if we get a full season in 2021, or at least close to a full season, his ceiling for his batting average is probably going to be closer to .275, which is still pretty good. I like Gregorius as a solid shortstop bat in fantasy. A lot of people are going to overlook him. He's not like a huge name shortstop like Corey Seager, but he does produce. He doesn't walk a ton, but he also doesn't strike out a ton, and he's not going to crater your batting average. I'd stay away in points leagues or leagues that value OBP, but in categories leagues or roto leagues, he's going to be at least a three-category guy for you, which is great. And if you count that 270-ish average as a positive, which I do, he could be a four-category guy for you. And that's at the shortstop position. One thing I do not like that definitely limits him is a well below average hard contact rate. He's averaged 27% hard contact over his career. I'm looking for guys that are well above that, in the high 30s, 40s for hard contact. Interestingly, two-thirds of his hits go for line drives or fly balls, which is really good. He's keeping the ball off the ground, and you know ground balls lead to easy outs, but because he's so limited in hard contact, it worries me that not enough of his line drives and fly balls are going to leave the park because he's simply just not hitting the ball hard enough. And, you know, soft fly balls can turn into outs, and that's a problem. So he likely is going to bat behind Harper in the lineup. That's how it went in 2020, and that's good for him. He's a legit shot to pick up some RBI, and, you know, he'll see some good balls to hit, maybe even get to take some walks, but I think the positives here outweigh the negatives for me with Gregorius. Don't reach for him, but also don't be disappointed if you get him. He's going to produce. Nelson Cruz just re-signed with the Twins. I don't think I'm going to tell you anything you don't know about Nelson Cruz. He's been around forever, but I'll try. One thing to note that you might not be aware of is that although his 300-plus batting average in each of the last two seasons looks great, he was buoyed both seasons by a way higher than normal BABIP. I think a more realistic expectation for him is a .280 batting average, which is closer to what he's hit in his career. He hasn't hit fewer than 37 home runs in a full season since 2014. In 120 games in 2019, he hit 41 home runs. And in 2020, he was on pace for 45. Those numbers are being driven a bit by a home run to fly ball rate in 2019 that was nearly 10% more than his average number. And in 2020, it was nearly 20% higher than normal. So don't get your hopes up too much to see more than 40 home runs. Although if things break his way, it's obviously possible. It's just not probable. He has a solid hard contact rate and he does hit a good number of fly balls. But what's going to limit him from consistently batting 300 is his plate discipline. He strikes out a bit, around 25% every year. His swing and strike percentage last year was about 15%, which is kind of high. And he chases balls out of the strike zone 30% of the time, which wouldn't be bad necessarily, but he only makes contact on about 50% of them. And I say all this to say that a 300 batting average is unsustainable for him on a consistent basis. The thing that really drove it was kind of luck, the luck of fly balls turning into home runs at a higher than normal rate for him the last 2 years, and those home runs leaving the park are gonna increase his batting average, and you know, so you see the spike, and that's why his BABIP was so high too, right? So don't treat 2020 and 2019 as the norm. You have to treat them as basically luck, a little bit of a fluke, but not totally a fluke. So basically, going into 2021, you have to draft him like he's going to be closer to a 38 home run, 280 hitter, rather than a 45 home run, 300 hitter. You also have to draft him knowing he's going to limit your fantasy lineup. In most leagues, there's only one slot a designated hitter can be put in, which is the utility slot. And putting him there is going to limit the flexibility of the rest of your lineup. If you want to move around multi-position eligible players, you know, to get good matchups, you want to get guys out of your lineup on days, you know, in or out of your lineup on days, depending on, you know, if it's a good or a bad matchup against a pitcher, right? You're gonna be limited in being able to do that because he's going to take one of those slots away every week, every day. But you know, the good should outweigh the bad with Nelson Cruz. I would value him in most leagues easily as a top 60 hitter, potential to be top 50, top 40 by the end of the season. Now, there is a huge trade in the last week, so let's get into that.
Deal or no deal?
What a huge trade. After years of speculation, the Rockies finally traded Arenado. And the only player they got in return that I think might have a chance at being fantasy relevant this year is Austin Gomber. He's a pitcher he can come out of the bullpen. He can start games. He can be a starting pitcher. So I think he'll find a role. And he has a chance to be a good spot starter here and there. Pick you up some strikeouts, but I don't think he's going to be very fantasy relevant. The rest of the players that got in the deal, I think a lot of Rockies fans are going to say they didn't get enough, but part of the reason why they didn't get a huge, you know, crazy haul that most people think they should have gotten is because Arenado has opt-outs in his deal, and they reworked the deal so that instead of opting out, being able to opt out after this season and the following season, he now opts out, can opt out after 2022 and 2023. So he should get a little bit more time with the Cardinals before being able to walk. Now, I don't think he's going to get a better deal than the one he's on right now. So I don't know if it will benefit him really to opt out after 2022 or 2023. I think we're going to see a decline in his stats in St. Louis, and so that's going to hurt his chances of getting a better contract later. So I think we'll see him play out most of this contract in St. Louis. Now, speaking of that, you know, speaking of the park factors, since Coors Field became Arenado's home in 2013, it has been the number one hitter's park 6 out of 8 seasons. And in those other 2 seasons, it was the second best park for hitters. So that has to be factored in for projecting what he'll do in his new park. In that same time frame, Busch Stadium in St. Louis has finished above 19th in park factors only once, making it a decidedly more pitcher-friendly park than Arenado's old home. So just how much will this affect his output? I think it's almost guaranteed we won't see him touch 40 home runs. One reason for this is that his splits for home and away are drastic, his career splits, especially for home runs. He's a 322 batter at home and a 263 batter away for his career. He has 136 home runs at Coors compared to 99 elsewhere. His slugging, OPS, and BABIP are all significantly higher in Coors Field, which prove that the park definitely impacts his overall performance. Now, in particular with Busch Stadium, he's only had 90 at-bats there, so it's, you know, hard to look at that as a true gauge for how he'll perform there over a full season and over, you know, a full couple of seasons. But in his career there, those 90 at-bats, he's batted 278 with 5 home runs in 24 games. If you project that to 81 home games, gives him 17 home runs. And if you compare that to his previous home splits in Colorado, that's a loss of several home ballpark home runs. So basically, I think that overall, you're bound to see a 5 to 10 home run dip for Arenado in 2021. I also think this move impacts his batting average. That's one of the biggest declines that we see from players leaving Coors Field, from batters leaving Coors Field, is that their batting average is impacted most. Now, he's been buoyed by an advantageous BABIP in Colorado because of how easy it is for balls to leave the park there. And so he's a career 290 hitter, but again, he's much better in Colorado than anywhere else. And I think we'll see closer to his career away split of 263 than his career 290 batting average. My expectation is we see something closer to 270 from him. I think he'll be a productive hitter. There's a lot of positives about him. He doesn't strike out very much. He has really solid hard contact numbers. He puts the ball in the air, which gives him a chance for home runs. He's a very disciplined hitter. He doesn't chase pitches. He doesn't swing and miss very much, but you have to know what you're getting going into this season. I think the move definitely lowers his value some and moves him outside that top five third baseman. I'd rank Machado, Rendon, Devers, Bregman, LeMahieu, and Jose Ramirez all ahead of him in most types of leagues. And so what about the players he's leaving behind in Colorado? How does this impact them? Well, I think Story loses some runs and some RBI. I think this makes it more likely for him to be a trade chip or to walk after this season. So if you have him in a keeper league or a dynasty league, that's something to consider as well. And I also think that it benefits players like Brendan Rodgers and Ryan McMahon, who are now going to get much more chances at bats. And so that inherently is going to give them more chance at productivity. Just something to watch as we go into spring training, which hopefully is happening very soon. In the back half of the episode today, I'm going to share some draft prep strategies with you that have helped me prepare for my leagues year after year. These are things that I do every year, and they help me stay competitive each year too. And so I'll get to that right after a word from my sponsor. For me, draft prep is a multi-step process that starts early in the off-season as soon as projections start popping up across different outlets. Some of my go-to websites for off-season prep include ESPN's Fantasy Baseball Projections, in particular anything on ESPN written by Eric Carabel or Tristan Cockcroft. I also follow Todd Zola on Twitter. He's a great source for fantasy baseball insight and is definitely under the radar. But he's an expert. I'm also constantly on Fangraphs and Baseball Reference, scouring for any piece of data that's going to give me an edge on draft day. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to let you in on my off-season process and my strategy, which keep me competitive year after year. So step one, the very first thing that I do is I go back and I look at last year's stats. I don't only look at just the surface stats, the home runs, RBI, things like that. I'm looking at hard contact rate, home run, fly ball, ground ball ratios, contact percent, BABIP, all of which I've done previous episodes on. And I'll revisit some of those stats this year in preseason sort of player evaluations, recap episodes. But aside from that, I'm going to Fangraphs to find a lot of the information I'll be discussing. And if you can't find something you're looking for on Fangraphs, then you should be checking baseballreference.com. To find pertinent information on Fangraphs, you can do it a few ways. I like to choose from the batting and pitching leaders at the top of the page and then sort through that way so I can see who is the best at certain things that I'm looking for. To see advanced stats on an individual player, all you have to do is click on their name from that leaderboard, or if you want to look up a particular player, you just look them up in the search bar. And most of what I'm looking for, I can find on Fangraphs, but one particular reason I use Baseball Reference is to check out batting splits. So like home and away, how did a batter do at different spots in the order, things like that. So that's something in particular that I use Baseball Reference for. Like looking at Nolan Arenado's home and away splits. That's Baseball Reference. Now when I'm scouting for who I want to draft and who I don't want to draft, when I'm thinking about ordering players in my rankings, I'm looking for a few things, and basically I'm trying to answer a few particular questions, at least for hitters. Who's hitting the ball hard? Are they hitting it hard and producing quality hits? Are they getting lucky, unlucky? Are they matching what they've done before? That can kind of be for hitters and pitchers. You know, along the lines, both ways, right? Are they more likely to be better or worse than this year based on, you know, their lineup? Are they on a new team? Are they coming back from an injury? Things like that. And then, another hitter pitcher question to answer. Did they take a step in the right direction or wrong direction? And so basically, I want to decide if I trust what a player did last year, and then decide how I think they'll do this year. And obviously, with 2020 being so strange of a season, you're going to have to look at more historical data or look at 2020 season data in context with a player's historical output. But again, this is a first step in a long process. And I do spend a good amount of time on player analysis and evaluation. Digging into the sabermetric stats, looking into why and how players produce certain numbers is super important for finding players that you think are going to be sleepers and players that you think are going to be busts. For example, I've talked about how I think Joe Musgrove could be maybe the biggest pitching sleeper this year because he increased his curveball usage, which led to more ground ball strikeouts and a lower ERA. And now he's going to a team that's likely to guarantee him more wins. But people are going to look at his history and they're going to say, oh, this was a fluke. He's a 4 ERA pitcher, but really he could be a top 20 pitcher this season. What the changes he made in 2020 were tangible. If you look in the data and understand it, you can see things like that. It's the same reason I see Arenado as a potential bust for where he's likely going to be drafted in a lot of leagues. You know, I think people are going to look at his past numbers and draft him like a top 5 third baseman, top 20 overall player, when he's probably going to end up valued or ranked closer to a top 40 player by the end of the season. And so researching and digging into the data can tell you these sorts of things and help inform your drafting. And also, you know, when you're in the season, it can help inform whether you drop or add players or how you trade. Now, as I'm researching players, I like to start a spreadsheet. I organize it by position and tiers, and I'll start plugging in players in an order that I would draft them. For example, tier one for my catchers is JT Realmuto. That's it. I view him as the best at the position based on the stats that I've chosen to focus on as most important to player evaluation, and he is decidedly better than all other catchers. Tier two for catchers for me includes Wilson Contreras, Salvi Perez, Grandal, Will Smith. These are guys who I like, but aren't the absolute best. Now, for me, not every position is going to have the same amount of players as other positions in the same tier. For example, right, catcher tier one has one player, but my tier one for first baseman is going to include three players: Bellinger, Freeman, Abreu. It's up to you to organize them how you want, remembering that as you continue your research, you know, it's likely you're going to switch a lot of these guys around. And so that gets into step two. We'll call this 2A for batters. The first thing is you want to read a lot and wait. Projections are going to come out. I use a mix of them. I check out Zips and the Bat on Fangraphs. I use the ESPN projections to help me finalize who I like the most, who I'm not going to draft, and in what order I want to sort my players. Now, this might take a few days or weeks even, depending on how deep you want to dig and how deep your league is as well. but take your time with it. You want to do this as soon as possible to give yourself enough time to look through each player, make notes, and do mock drafts. Once I've combed through the projections and I've analyzed those underlying metrics, that's when I begin to make decisions on players that I'm going to target and that I'm not going to target, and players who I think are under the radar, my sleepers. So in a lot of drafts, the players who you choose are going to depend on a lot of things. Is it a keeper draft? What pick do you have? Who's on the board? How many teams, right? It's important you know what type of league, the roster construction, the rules. You should know if you're in a league with a snake draft versus an auction, right? That'll make a difference to your draft strategy. If you're in a keeper league, that's going to impact things as well. One thing I also like to do as a second step in sorting my players, whether it's a hitter or a pitcher, is I assign each player a color on my spreadsheet. You can choose whichever colors you want. I have a key to help me, you know, in case I forget what color, but I've been doing it so long, it's all the same. Green for me means I like them, I want to draft them. Red is my don't draft list. Yellow is a sleeper. Blue is a player who's being kept on another team. Orange is a player kept by me. And so on draft day, I use this to help me make quick decisions. As players are chosen, I delete them from the list. Another thing you should do is make notes. So for my batters, I'm looking for players who are going to produce kind of across the board stats. And so sometimes, like this year, I'm going to focus on players who hit for power, because generally they're at least going to get you three categories: runs, home runs, and RBI. That strategy might change if you're in a points league, but so what I do is I'll use an asterisk or other symbols for players who I think in particular are going to do things like go 20-20, meaning have 20 home runs and 20 steals. Or if a player is going into the season injured, or if there's someone injury prone, I'll assign a symbol to them. So this year, I'm not too worried to find players who are hitting for average. What I want is players who are going to fill in three batting columns, and that works for me. And then I'll do the same thing with pitchers. I want to find pitchers who can get me at least three columns of stats. And, you know, I put myself in a good position each week to win. But again, the type of league you're in, the rules are going to impact the way that you draft. So it's very important. And step 2B for pitchers, you know, I've been talking a lot about sorting batters. I also sort my pitchers too, but I do it a little differently. Last season, I did some episodes on pitching sabermetrics and how I use them. So similarly, I'll do a recap before this season starts on some of those. So I still sort my pitchers into tiers, but my pitching tiers are divided by projected ERA. And you can kind of split them up however you want. But generally, I'm not listing pitchers who are going to have an ERA above 4.20, because I won't draft them. I go through the exact same process as hitters when I do my research. What they do last year, can it be repeated? What factors might change their output for this year in either direction? I'll look at data, projections, and make my decisions. I use my color coding. I do the same process with starters and relievers as well. And as with batters, I'm looking for pitchers who are going to produce in multiple categories. My league uses quality starts instead of wins. I'm making notes of which players are likely to strike out 200 batters or more. I'll use a symbol for them. You know, I'll choose sometimes pitchers who I think could strike out a lot of players at the expense of ERA somewhat. You know, but I want that balanced out with, are they going to get me quality starts? So knowing this, right, and doing this is going to depend on how my draft is going and how things shake out. And so part of this process is, you know, mock drafting, seeing how things go and developing this strategy. So I either want two or three starters with 200 plus projected strikeouts, or if I don't get what I want, that's one of those times where I might shift my focus and stock up on relievers. And so the reason why some people do that is, you know, if you get a couple of the top relief pitchers, you can still win a couple categories each week: saves, ERA, and WHIP. Right. So you might have to pivot in your draft. And that's, again, something that doing a mock draft will help out with a lot, which I'll talk about in a moment. So one thing to remind you about is I'm talking about these, my league, you know, I'm talking about my strategy for, you know, categories, head-to-head, roto leagues. You'll have to adjust that, the strategy in points leagues and, you know, in leagues where there's different categories or different stats being measured. Like for some leagues, they do holds and losses and innings pitched, right? So knowing what's valuable in your league is also important to your scouting. And whatever website you use, they should have a place where you can mock draft. My league is on ESPN, so I use their mock draft lobby. It's a great place to practice your strategy, see what works, see what doesn't, and plan on what you're going to do on draft day. It's a little difficult with a keeper league, but do what you can. Make sure to practice with your spreadsheet or whatever you're using for research. I keep track of each mock draft that I do and take notes of things that I liked about my teams and things that I need to get better at before I actually draft. I also find it helps me identify which players are valued maybe too high or too low. It gives me an idea of where certain players are valued. So let's say I'm going into the year thinking I'm going to draft JT Realmuto like 60th overall, where I value him. Well, if he keeps getting taken in the top 50 in mock drafts over and over, I know that I'm either going to have to reach higher than I want in order to get him, or when I get to my draft, I'll adjust my strategy and look for a catcher later. But again, you can do as many mocks as you want. All they do is provide you with information. It's one of the biggest keys to drafting success and getting a team that you want and you're happy with when the draft is done. My post-draft trademark with my friends is me telling them that I won the draft because I almost always feel comfortable across the board with my team. So this is my draft process, my pre-draft process. It's extensive, it's thorough, but it works. Next week, I'm going to do a crash course in several hitting sabermetric stats that you can look into as you scout for your coming season and that you can use to make decisions during the season. And we'll stick with a few episodes like that of recap of stats that I went over last season. And then as mock drafts open up, I'll be doing some episodes where I'll review my mock drafts and evaluate them to give you some idea of where players are being drafted and what I'm thinking about roster construction. I'm also planning on doing player rankings this year, so I'll let you know when and where those rankings become available. So make sure you've subscribed so that you're notified when those episodes publish. I'm also writing fantasy baseball and baseball betting articles for thegameday.com. So check out thegameday.com, look for my articles there. I'll be writing about some things that I cover here on the podcast, but there's some things that I might spend more time on in the writing, on the website. So be sure to check not just here, but also thegameday.com, and you can see what other people are writing as well. And finally, please give the show a 5-star rating. Each high rating helps to move my podcast up on the list on all the podcast platforms when people search for fantasy baseball. So it's something that really helps me, and I really appreciate. You can follow me on Instagram at Fastball Fantasy Baseball. You can follow me on Twitter at Fastball Pod. And feel free to email the show at fastballfantasybaseball@gmail.com with any comments, questions, or ideas. Thanks for listening.